Penguin Random House Audio presents Fairest, a memoir. This is the author, Meredith Toulousan. For Josh. Ang hindi lumingon sa pinanggalingan, hindi makakarating sa paroroonan. One who does not look back at their origin will never arrive at their destination. Tagalog proverb. There are some who, should we intrude upon them in the morning, still in bed, will present to our gaze an admirable female head, so generalized and typical of the entire sex is the expression of the face, the hair itself affirms it, so feminine is its ripple, unbrushed, it falls so naturally, in long curls over the cheek, that one marvels how the young woman, the girl, the Galatea, barely awakened to life in the conscious mass of this male body, in which she is imprisoned, has contrived so ingeniously, by herself, without instruction from anyone else, to take advantage of the narrowest aperture in her prison wall to find what was necessary to her existence. Marcel Proust, Sodom and Gomorrah. Beauty is power, longing a disease. Stephen Sondheim, Passion. Author's note. If you may pardon the faults of memory and the bias of personal perspective, this work is otherwise both truthful and factual, except that some names have been changed out of respect for privacy. Prologue. Bridges of Light. Red brick, white tent, green grass. The outlines of prestige at an inner courtyard on a drizzly day. That was what I saw, the same as what I remembered, the specifics fuzzy from afar, my albino eyes only able to render life in scant detail unless I held it close. But I couldn't well squat down to examine those blades of grass under my feet as I entered the cover of that tent, not at a reunion reception for queer students at Harvard, whether at that moment in 2017, or when I graduated in 1997. I couldn't reveal myself a freak, especially not in this crowd, which would damn me for my failure of sight. I arrived at this reception from New York, passing several bodies of water by train, but somehow the Charles still stood out to me when I took the T from South Station, the vast expanse of it, the first substantial body of water I crossed after the Pacific Ocean, when I left the pain of my childhood and hurtled to a future of great promise. This was a memory I could only vaguely make out from the distance of time, though I was used to the feeling, since my physical vision could never represent anything far except as blurs. My way of seeing had advantages, though. Since I couldn't perceive detail from far away, I could more easily associate what I saw with my past, like how those language philosophers say that when a person hears the word chair, they picture an idealized chair in their mind, drawn from an amalgam of memories. My vision was like that all the time, except it absorbed the few details I could actually see and integrated them with the objects I imagined. Unable to identify any specific blade of grass on this occasion, I could imagine the blurry mass under my feet as the same uniform stalks of verdant green I'd stepped on 20 years earlier, and so became two people without much effort. The person who arrived today, and the young man from the afternoon of my improbable graduation from the most prestigious university in the world. Me, a child from a Philippine province, descendant of peasant farmers, son of derelict immigrants. Except, I was no longer a son, no longer a man. I became more aware of this as groups of gay men, mostly aging or aged, circulated around me. Their manner of casual evaluation was all too familiar from the countless gay occasions I'd been exposed to. Clubs, parties, rallies, meetings, events where official interactions were always tinged with the energy of male desire. Though having such blurry vision made me pay closer attention to what I could perceive, and what I saw was the change in how those men approached and retreated. The way their bodies created invisible patterns in space. The distinction between being observed but found wanting and being dismissed offhand, the difference between being a not-so-hot guy and a woman. It's kind of fun to see a bunch of boys who rejected me under the same tent, a droll voice behind me said, whose owner I immediately identified as Kit Clark, a black alum who was several classes ahead of me, but had worked at Harvard after graduation and never left. We got back in touch a few years earlier, so he was one of the few people I'd seen since I finished college. "Haven't snagged one yet?" I asked as I turned to face him. "It's a lot worse than when you were here," he replied. "The men keep getting younger and I'm only getting uglier." I would protest if it were anyone else, but Kit's tone had always made it clear that he did not invite praise whenever he said something negative about his appearance. What he invited was empathy, agreement with the injustice of how looks so determined our place in the gay pecking order, and how our lack of attractiveness had so much to do with our race and femininity. Kit's broad, open face, his strong jaw, his wide nose, would not be considered ugly, if not for the kinky hair he kept long. His olive skin would have also been attractive, except that it didn't come with the hyper-masculinity that seemed to be a prerequisite for black gay men to be thought hot. Instead, Kit refused to subject his tall, lanky frame to the rigors of a gym regimen and preferred activities like circus silks and modern dance, which he could perform with a lithe grace. "You can always leave Cambridge," I suggested. "You're not serious. My life is here. I accept that I'm undesirable." This struck me as a fundamental difference between us, and why I'd kept my friendship with Kit at arm's length over the years, because his self-acceptance rattled me. Kit would not allow himself to butch it up or keep his hair short just to court suitors. He wanted to be wanted, but he wouldn't compromise himself for the sake of another's desire. I, on the other hand, didn't have the same solid sense of self. I'd been more than willing to clamp down on my most undesirable traits, especially 2 decades ago, when I had such an unclear sense of who I was beyond other people's reflections of me. At the same time, Kit recognized long before I did how alike we were, that we both occupied liminal places in our white-dominated Harvard gay society. He recognized me as an albino Asian when everybody else thought I was white. He could tell that my workout regimen was cover for femininity I obscured because it was not attractive. He could also tell that someone needed to see the reality of me, even when I took such pains to hide it. And Kit generously gave my inner self a witness, even when I could never settle for long under his glare. Kit motioned to someone who approached us, and when he got close, I surprised myself when I recognized Sean Chambers, an English lit grad student while I was in college. His appearance had not changed much, just a few more pounds and a widow's peak, his red hair duller than I remembered. "I'm Meredith," I said. "I remember you," he replied. I couldn't tell whether he'd learned about my transition through the grapevine or if he was just good at going with the flow, though the change between old and new me wasn't as drastic as it used to be. I'd cut my hair in a bob and was not wearing makeup, had on a loose gray jumpsuit that could be feasibly worn by a man or a woman. "Do you recognize anyone else?" I asked. Sean motioned with his head toward a man passing by in tight jeans and a white shirt under his blazer. The man's tan skin seemed leathery to me even from a distance, his hair equal parts pepper and salt. "Vince Parker. I had a crush on him," Sean said. "He was so hot." "Everyone had a crush on him," Kit rejoined. As Kit and Sean gossiped about how attractive Vince had been, I reflected on the word "was." I imagined that the man would feel hurt to be spoken of like this, his beauty in the past tense. "Anyway, we all get older and uglier," Kit concluded. "Except for Meredith," Sean said as he turned to me. "You look the same." "Isn't it weird," Kit observed, "how she changed genders and looks more like she did 20 years ago than any of us?" I chuckled then. I used to look really different when I wore heels, dresses, and a full face of makeup nearly every day. But as I put more and more of my thoughts out into the world, I also grew wary of the need to conform to that world's expectations of me. So the heels came off, then the makeup, then the girly clothes.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?